This episode of Love to Sew is sponsored by Spoonflower. The first company of its kind, Spoonflower was launched in 2008 in Durham, North Carolina, with the dream of empowering individuals to print and sell their own artwork on fabric, wallpaper, and gift wrap.
Today, the Spoonflower community has grown to over 4 million creative individuals who use their own designs and the Spoonflower marketplace to make all kinds of creative projects. With more than 750,000 designs available, there's something for everyone.
You can receive 15% off your next Spoonflower order at try.spoonflower.com/love to sew. That's try.spoonflower.com/love to sew. And now onto the show. Da 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 da. Da 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 da. Hello and welcome. I'm Caroline.
And I'm Helen.
And we love to sew. This is a podcast for makers where we talk about sewing a handmade wardrobe and bring you interviews with inspiring creatives and small business owners in our community.
Today we are talking with River Takata Capel, a fiber artist and workshop instructor who spends her summers working with kids. River chats with us about running a sustainable small business, teaching kids to sew, and how children can show us how to go with the flow and leave the perfectionism at the door.
You mean in the cubby?
In the cloakroom.
Where is this cloakroom? I want to find it. Sounds wonderful.
Hello, River. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is River Takata Capel. I have a small business called Riv Talk, which is short for my name, River Takata, the first three letters of those two words. And I am a fiber artist, a fiber instructor, and a homemaker. And I focus a lot on just keeping my hands busy, going from one project to another project, really expanding like all of my creative designs and making them tangible, because that really helps with my kind of just getting through the day and also connecting with other people who are really interested in textiles and crafts the way I am. So I try to combine my business with my community, with my personal life. So it's all very interconnected. But I don't really like to call it like a brand so much, because that I just don't connect with that idea of like having my own personal brand, because I'm kind of all over the place.
We love that you're all over the place. I mean, there's so much variety in your work and everything that you do. So we're excited to chat with you about everything today. But first, I wanted to say that your name is so cool. Probably the coolest name of any guest we've had so far on the show. And
oh,
we were wondering if is there a story behind the name River? Why did your parents choose to name you River?
So there is not really a great story. It's a little bit random. I am the third child. I have two older sisters. My sisters also have really cool names. My oldest sister is Alta, A-L-T-A. My other sister's name is Beniko. And I think I was supposed to be a Christopher, because both my siblings are girls, or my older sisters. And I was supposed to be a Christopher, but I came out not a boy. So at the last minute, they still named me a like non-gender name. Like it could have been a boy's name, could have been a girl's name, but that's how I got the name River. It was a last minute thing. So, which I'm really, really thankful
for. Well, it's a great
name. Yeah. I feel like I poetically draw a lot of strength from the name River, and it helps that it's like a little bit of a noun, because I can come up with all of these funny like little things like the salty river or the raging river and kind of like laugh at myself. And nowadays I'm meeting a lot of people who want to name their kids River, and it's, you know, it makes me really happy that it's going to become a more popular name, because I've always really been into it.
Awesome. So where are you from and where did you grow up?
I grew up in Carrboro, North Carolina. It's a very, very small little town, about like 4 square miles, but it's right next to a larger town called Chapel Hill. And originally I was born in Tokyo. My mom is Japanese. She moved to the States in her mid-20s, and my dad is from North Carolina. So that's kind of how we ended up in North Carolina. And now I live in Durham, North Carolina, which is about 30 minutes away from where I grew up in Carrboro. But it's another kind of step up, a little bit of a bigger city. There's a lot of tech startup here. There's a big university, a big hospital, and there's a lot of support for the creative community here.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome to hear. We wanted to ask you about your sewing journey and how and when you learned to sew.
So I learned how to sew really young. My mom and my grandmother are both really into sewing. So my mom actually came to the States because of textiles and because of crafts. And so that was always in our household growing up. And so I started sewing, like, I'm not really quite sure when, but I know for a fact that I started sewing on a machine in the third grade.
Awesome. So you've been sewing for a long time.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you always considered yourself a fiber artist, or was there an area of sewing that you were interested in initially and then sort of branched out to all these different things?
So initially, I was really into clothing, making my own clothes, finding my voice and my identity through what I was wearing and what I could create with what was available around me. And as the years have gone on and more sustainable and affordable and like really cool clothing has become more readily available, I've kind of moved away from making just clothing and gotten into doing all sorts of different crafts. So not just clothing, but quilting and making accessories and lots of home goods.
That's awesome. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of the work that you do right now and kind of what fills your days. I would love to know if you could give us like a little rundown of your business, your website, what our listeners can find on there and what kind of you do every day.
Yeah. So every day I try and do a little bit of sewing or some kind of creative work to create a tangible thing that I can hold in my hands and be like, I made this, and really feel connected to what I do for my job. Because for the most part, I spend my days doing production sewing. So a lot of that stuff I pass on to other people, to other stores or direct to customer. So I do a lot of accessories, headbands and home goods. And it's hard for me to organize exactly like what it is that I do because I go from project to project kind of as a standalone thing. I don't really have like a product line or a line sheet. And since I'm the only person sewing for myself right now, I can really switch very sporadically from project to project. And sometimes I will come into the studio and I won't really have direction of what I'm working on specifically, but there's always a stack of fabric that just needs to be cut down. And so maybe I'll spend an hour or two just cutting down fabric and putting it with the lining that it needs to be with. And then that kind of gets set aside. And maybe that will inspire me to, okay, finish this other project over here that is sitting next to the sewing machine. That's, I just need to change out the thread color and do a run of those headbands really quick. And then maybe the next hour later, I'll be like, I am in such a groove. I'm going to do that 30 minutes of personal sewing. And each day is kind of like that, where I'm kind of going from project to project as to what I am feeling in the moment. And then some days are far more structured and I don't get to do any crafting at all. So I am tagging items. I'm ironing things. I am doing emails, communicating with shops. I sell my handmade goods at like 12 different women-owned businesses. So there's a lot of communication that needs to be done, invoices that need to be sent. And then my favorite part is delivering those goods to the store. So driving and getting to hook up with my business owner friends and just chatting with them about what's happening in their stores and kind of doing display and merchandising is another big aspect of kind of presenting my own work. Right now, for the holiday season, every weekend I'm doing one or two craft markets. So some days prior to my craft market, I'll be doing like a practice display, which will again incorporate like tagging things or creating signage. Or there's a lot of Tetris, idea Tetris and actual stuff Tetris So when I'm getting ready to make deliveries, there's a lot of like scheduling Tetris of like, okay, I need to run to the post office and deliver these online orders on my way to dropping these things off at this store or doing this thing. And then the stuff Tetris is getting ready for a market. There's a lot of like loading and unloading my car and getting all of my display items and product to fit into my car. And then having it, you know, not be all over the place so that I can unload it really quickly, set up my booth and get ready to be present to talk to a bunch of people. So, wow, when I talk about it out loud, I'm really all over the place. But I kind of attribute it to my crafting ADD. And right now I am in a place in my life where I am very flexible and I'm kind of going with the flow. I've lived my life at other points being very structured and not having time to be creative or making excuses and not giving myself time to be creative. So this year and hopefully this coming year, I will continuously just do whatever my creative whimsy takes, wherever it takes me, which means that it's kind of unorganized, which isn't a bad thing because I feel like that means that I am just going with it.
The creative chaos.
Yes. Yeah, but it feels like it's an organized chaos for sure. That's the epitome of my life, organized chaos. I have this little angel placket from my grandmother's garage, and it says, "Bless this mess." And that is just my whole life.
It sounds like a fun balance between being creative and also managing the business side of things, and that you're, you know, playing to your strengths and just letting yourself be who you are in that space. And I really like that about, you know, the way that you've set up your business. And I think that there's probably listeners out there who would be interested in doing something similar where they're making creative projects and then perhaps selling them at fairs or selling them in stores. So can you give us a bit of a breakdown of how you got started with all that? Like, how did you sell your first product?
Yes. So this kind of goes back to my origins. My mom is an entrepreneur. So I definitely feel like I always had a sense of just make it and do it. And if people want it, then they'll, you know, trade something or they'll pay you. So I started selling stuff as early as high school, but more formally when I was heading to school at Haywood Community College, which is actually a professional crafts program. And I was leaving Carrboro to move to Western North Carolina to start this textile program. I was cleaning out my closet and I had a few garments that were handmade from scratch that I had made for myself. And I took them to a local vintage consignment store. And the two owners of Roulette Vintage was the name of the store. They looked at my clothes for consignment and they were like, "Wow, these look handmade." And I was like, "Yes, I made them. I made them for myself. And, you know, I'm trying to make some money because I'm about to move." And they were like, "Well, if you want to sell your stuff here or if you make more stuff, like, we would be interested in doing that." So I moved to the mountains shortly after that. So I was about 3 hours away from this store. But I really kept that in mind that, like, oh, like these ladies, they want me to make things and they'll sell it for me. And that kind of gave me the confidence to move forward with my business while I was enrolled in school. So in my early on days of making and selling stuff, which my business has evolved many, many times, but in the early days, it was a lot of going to the thrift store and collecting really cool vintage items, just anything that caught my eye, it being the pattern on the fabric or the texture or just the weird shape of it. And I would, you know, clean the items, mend them up, replace buttons, patch things, and sometimes I would alter them completely. So taking like a men's oversized sweater and making them into kind of like pinafore overall skirts, or the town that I was living in the mountains had like a number of country clubs. So a lot of the clothing that I was finding in thrift stores were these like oversized men's clothing. And so I was able to do a few lines or collections based off of this, you know, just things that I was finding at this thrift store down the street from my house in the mountains. And then I would send them to the store in Carrboro and they would sell them for me. And I was able to earn enough to, you know, pay some of my bills and buy more thrifted items and pay for gas to come back into town and deliver things or ship things. And it just kind of kept on going from there.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think people imagine that, you know, when you're getting your stuff into stores, it involves this nerve-wracking process of going to a store and trying to pitch yourself to them and showing them your products and having it be this sort of stressful experience. But it sounds like for you, it was a little bit more of an organic process where it kind of just ended up happening and it sounds like it was kind of meant to be and then evolved from there. So I think it's interesting to think of it that way for our listeners out there who are maybe, you know, nervous about doing something like that. Maybe try to look at opportunities as they come and not so much think of it as a scary experience.
Yeah, where you need like 100 products.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a scary experience. I think finding store owners that I really jived with very early on and who were so supportive of me really helped launch that confidence within myself. Previous to that, I had done some jewelry when I was living in Savannah. I went to Savannah College of Art and Design for a very short period of time, and I was wearing one of my pieces, and, you know, someone at a boutique in Savannah was like, "Oh, that's so cool. Are you a student? Like, we would carry your stuff." And I was like shocked, and I like never really went back and spoke to them because I was so intimidated. I was like, oh, I need to have multiple products at multiple price points to show them. And I need to have like my supplies ready to go. So if they place a really large order, I'll be ready to fulfill it. And it never happened, never moved forward. I kind of slept on that opportunity. So, you know, maybe like a year later when I was inadvertently encouraged to bring clothing in instead, which I had a lot of fabric available to me just through like my sourcing through thrift stores and flea markets and estate sales and whatnot. But I was like, oh, this is way more doable. And the fact that I was selling at a store that was within my style range, I guess, since, you know, the women who are running the store were really catering towards people who are into kind of funky, one-of-a-kind pieces, vintage clothing, vintage-inspired clothing. That is like so my style that I felt really inspired to make items for their customer. Like I felt like I am their customer, so I can just make things that I like for myself. And that made it so much more approachable. So I think just finding that really supportive environment helped. Also, I feel like things have really changed. That story took place almost 12 years ago. So things have changed now. And I think, you know, I would not expect a store owner to welcome me with open arms if I like cold emailed or cold called them and was like, hey, I'm coming by with a bunch of samples and you're going to carry it and you're going to love it. I really feel like that doesn't work maybe ever, but you never know what's going to happen.
You'll never know until you try.
Exactly. Yes.
And I'm curious too about the pricing structure, because when you're talking about garments, like I can think about the cost of materials, even though you're sourcing from thrift stores and things like that, you know, the materials and then also your time. And how do you decide how much to charge for something like that to make it fair to you as the maker?
Yes. So I work with two pricing structures. I work with the cost produced pricing structure, which is taking the cost of materials, multiplying that by two, which just makes sense because you're covering the cost of what you just bought, and then you need to cover the cost of the next item. So starting there, and then keeping track of my time kind of loosely, but, you know, trying to stay on top of that and kind of figuring out how much I want to pay myself per hour, and then tacking on kind of like a studio fee on top of that. So that's kind of like the overhead costs. And the way to figure out that overhead cost is kind of to determine like, okay, this is the cost of my overhead, my studio, whatever, you know, like gas to get there, sewing notions, maybe wear and tear on my sewing machine, and how much is that per month? And then let's say if I'm going to make 50 garments in a month, then I can kind of divide my overhead by the number of garments. And then I kind of tack that studio fee onto each individual item. So that is your cost to make it, pretty basic pricing structure. And then the other pricing structure that I work with is what the market can bear. So pretty much just doing research as to what other people who are making something similar to me are charging and see if my market, which is going to be different from, you know, other people who are more established, what my market can bear. So, and then finding that kind of in-between price point is what works for me. Having 20 some years of sewing experience makes me feel like I should charge more for my sewing because I can sew very quickly. So my, you know, my price per hour is going to be much higher than a price per hour for someone who's just beginning and maybe takes longer to do the same amount of work. So when someone comes to me and they're like, oh, I want a custom item, I give them the kind of like what it costs to make it price point. But when I'm doing production work where I can really speed through items and I'm making them in batches, I kind of go, I lean more towards the what the market can bear. Like one of my bread and butter products for the past 6 years are headbands. I just make headbands and sell them at, you know, 12 stores and tons of markets. And they're not the most exciting thing that I make, that's for sure, but they definitely help pay the bills. And I have priced them at $14. And that is roughly about how much it costs to, you know, cover the cost of making them, make sure that I actually make profit. But I also take into consideration that I want them to be under $15. You know, there's that psychology of when someone looks at a price tag, they think, oh, you know, it's $18. That's almost $20. $20 is like at the top of my price range or whatever, versus a $14 item, which is, you know, less than $15. It's almost $10 kind of thing. So there's a little bit of psychology that goes behind pricing each item. I'm sure this is a little bit more information than anybody really wants to hear. but when I am working creatively, part of my creative process is finding a very efficient and sustainable way of making something. So let's say I'm making stuff and I'm just like, oh my God, this is so great. And I'm like timing how long it takes me to make it. And I'm like, oh wow, that thing took me 6 hours to make. And so like, maybe I'm not going to sell those, but it was really fun. And maybe I'll teach a workshop on how to make those instead of charging people $300 for it, because frankly, in Durham, I want things to be very approachable and affordable. And same with in stores, you know, I want those price points to be somewhere where people are like, oh, wow, I'm supporting this, you know, I'm supporting River. So I want it to be approachable. Now, if I wanted to do a completely different line, I would, you know, with more expensive materials or materials that I am buying brand new, then yes, I would have to go with the cost of the item. But, you know, as we kind of talk more about my process, I can tell you a little bit more about like the whole eco ethos that goes into my work, which is all about using materials that I have available to me more readily and that don't cost a bunch. And that is a key point of keeping my price point low and affordable.
Yeah, this is so interesting. And I have been following you on Instagram and you were showing some of the products that you offer or that you're offering right now at craft fairs. And some of them were kind of pillows and soft home goods that you had made out of scraps from your previous job where you had, you know, some fabric scraps left over and you were using them to make products. And I just think it's so cool that you're kind of utilizing the materials that you have and in a way kind of recycling things that maybe wouldn't have been used otherwise. So I think this is a really great approach to building a creative business like the one that you have. So briefly, let's talk a little bit about this eco-friendly ethos and tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so this is an ethos that I've carried with me through my entire craft career. Eco kind of stands for ecological and economically friendly. And I focus on what's available. And since so much already exists in the field of textiles, I have been able to keep all of my products very low waste. And that keeps the cost of running my business very, very low so that I can focus on other things in life while offering affordable and sustainable products. And the ethos of it being eco-conscious, you know, that kind of living a low-waste lifestyle makes me feel better about the amount of stuff that I'm creating and adding into the world. So that helps with, you know, just the mentality of why am I doing this? And I can kind of go back to that standpoint of like, I am reducing the amount of stuff that's out there as a raw material and presenting it to my friends and my community without creating more waste for them to have to deal with down the road. And so that kind of keeps me going. That keeps me running my business a few times, you know, maybe a few times a year. I'm like, what am I doing with my time? I am just surrounded by all this stuff, because one of the pitfalls of this ethos is that I am constantly collecting materials, because I'm like, oh, that bolt of organic cotton knit that's at this going out of business sale, like that's, you know, $20 for that whole 50 yard roll. Like, obviously I have no plans to use that, but I have to buy it.
I mean, I would buy
that. I was just going to say, that sounds like a great deal.
Right? I know. And like those deals pop up all the time, especially living in the Southeast of America. It's just like, there's so many textile mills around here. There's so many textile-based companies within 2 or 3 hours of where I live that it's really easy to use materials that are salvaged or remnant or that are going to be shredded anyways, or that are getting donated to a thrift store, or that are going to get dumped out if people don't come pick it up off the side of the road. So I definitely have a storage unit full of fabric is the end of that story.
I love this admission. So that means I have a storage unit. Okay. So we really want to talk to you about all of these workshops that you do and what we were intending on talking about sewing with kids and all of that kind of stuff, but we're so into this conversation. So before we move on, I did want to ask you, because I really want our listeners to kind of have a visual idea in their mind of what you do, since, you know, it is a, you know, audio podcast. They're not going to be able to see photos right now, but can you give us some examples of how you incorporate these secondhand goods into your work?
Yes. So 11 years ago, when I started selling clothing at that store I was just telling you about, that was all items salvaged from the thrift store, flea markets, estate sales. So it was more upcycling. It was like ready-made items that I was changing up and upcycling them. So that is kind of the best way to reuse items, is literally just to reuse them. And then as my life changed, my lifestyle changed, and my business evolved, I've been sourcing more straight from textile mills and fabric companies. So now I have more raw materials. So this is, these are materials that are pre-consumer waste. So the stuff that I was just talking about, thrift store, flea markets, that's post-consumer waste. That's stuff that has already been used and kind of is just looking for a second life. Pre-consumer waste is stuff that comes directly off of the factory floor. Let's say they're samples, or they're runoffs, or they're slightly damaged, or they're, you know, manufactured too wide so they don't fit into this machine or that machine. So there's constantly a ton of just factory remnants laying around out there in the world. So that is pre-consumer waste. It's never been used before, but I didn't order it from a company necessarily. I more so just went out and picked what I could use out of the salvaged materials. So now that I have access and a storage unit where I can store things, now I can kind of collect more of those raw materials. So my business has evolved from doing lots of in the field foraging, as I call it, that thrifting and whatnot, to just larger amounts of fabric, which I then cut down, I hand dye it, screen print it, and sew it into something. So some products that I make out of this pre-consumer textile waste is really anything that I can sew, from blankets to linen towels to zipper pouches to pillows. And for the most part, I pick natural fabrics so that I can dye them. I use natural dyes, indigo, and other plant-based dyes like, you know, goldenrod or avocado pits for very small scale things. I also use Procyon dyes or acid dyes sometimes. And so I like to focus on those natural fibers that I can dye. And then once I have the dyed fabric, I cut them down, process them, and figure out what I'm going to make out of them. And kind of taking that step, focusing on certain areas of the dyed fabric as if it was like a canvas, and then kind of drawing out shapes onto that, then screen printing. So a batch of pouches that I just made for the holiday season to sell at markets and to drop off at a local store here in Durham. They're like makeup bags or toiletry bags or, you know, just little pouches. So I had hand dyed a bunch of fabric. Then I marked off how big those pouches were going to be. And then I screen printed an original little illustration that I made into a screen directly onto the yardage while it was one big giant piece of yardage with my products drawn out onto it. Then I cut them out and heat set them, and then I sewed them into pouches, and then I'm taking them to market.
Wow. I love that you're taking these materials and truly transforming them. You know, you're not just using them as is. You're going through all of these different steps and really making it something unique. And I hope our listeners go and look at some of your products on your website and check you out, because it's fun to look at your stuff. They're all very engaging and interesting. And yeah, very unique pieces.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about running this creative business is just if you've noticed a shift in the last 10 years or so, because I feel like this maker movement has really taken off. And not only is there more appreciation for what people like you do and the time that it takes, but also maybe an interest in learning how to do it themselves. Have you noticed a shift in that regard?
Yes, I feel like the game has changed so much from the days where I was thrifting and reselling vintage clothes. For one thing, I feel like the trends are always changing. So when I first started out 10 years ago, I'm like really inspired by street fashion in Tokyo. And I feel like that hadn't quite come over to the stateside. So I was, you know, pulling a lot of inspiration from like really funky things that people in Japan were getting American vintage and like remaking it. And I was like bringing that back to America and like remaking American vintage to sell to Americans. And that trend has really evolved. Japanese street fashion has really evolved and also like seeped its way into international fashion. And it's also like just taken a turn for like, you know, a more sleek and produced look, I guess. And it's definitely not as scrappy as it used to be. So I feel like the standard of clothing has been elevated. I also have in my notes here that like when I was growing up and making clothes for myself, the only clothing stores that were available to me, like locally, were like Old Navy and like Abercrombie and Fitch, just like really soulless and like personality-less like clothing brands. And so I was really inspired to like make my own clothing. Whereas I feel like now there are so many clothing brands that exude personality that are really readily available for people to buy online. So that trend has really evolved and changed. Thus, like people's consumerism has really evolved. And so now with just crafts being more available and people being more educated about like, what is a realistic price point for a handcrafted item? Like, I feel like consumers are more educated as to how that works. And so they realize, oh, you know, if I want to buy that hand woven wall hanging, I could go and buy it at a very reasonable price for $100+, because that is literally how long it takes. And look, I can do this research and find all these other makers who are doing something similar, and all of their price points are comparable to that, you know? Thus, I think that does push people to, well, maybe I should try and figure out how to do this on my own. And there are lots of people who kind of want to dabble in that. And I think they're that inspiration that we're all looking at Pinterest and Instagram, And we're seeing these beautiful things that people are making and thinking, oh, I want to try my hand at that, you know. And I love doing workshops because a lot of times I just want to try something, or I just need a little bit of encouragement to do this thing that I've been inspired by for a while. So not only do I teach workshops, but I also take workshops all the time. So I'm a part of that wave as well of just, I just want to try it, you know, and I want someone to guide me along the way. I feel like part of my personal practice has been like feeling around in the dark and figuring it out on my own. And having done that for 10 plus years, I am all about going straight to the source and having an expert tell me how to do it because I'm not messing around anymore. I want help. I don't have to figure out how to do it on my own. I find more power in asking for help. Whereas, you know, back in my 20s, when I was maybe a little bit more stubborn, I was all about figuring it out, how to do it on my own, not listening to anybody else's advice. And nowadays I'm like, oh, I just want to have fun and relax. So I'm going to pay someone to teach me how to do this. And I love it.
Yeah. Helen and I love taking workshops as well, especially, you know, not only online workshops, but in-person workshops. There's something about going somewhere and learning how to do something with a group of people.
This episode of Love to Sew is sponsored by Spoonflower. Thousands of entrepreneurs, makers, and businesses, big and small, are powered by Spoonflower's on-demand digital print process. They are your marketplace, your supplier, and your warehouse.
Spoonflower is proud to support small business owners like River, who's actually a former Spoonflower employee. Did you know they donated unprinted remnants to River for her shibori workshops? So cool.
There are over 20 plus available fabrics, so you can find just the right fabric for every project, plus gift wrap and wallpaper, including their fan favorite peel and stick wallpaper that is removable and repositionable. Not all peel and sticks are alike, and theirs is also 100% recyclable.
Also, Spoonflower has tons of cut and sew fat quarter projects, which are great for teaching kids how to sew. You know the drill, we're gonna link them in the show notes for you all.
With over 750,000 designs, it's easy to make one-of-a-kind garments. If you're a creative person who loves to design, there's nothing quite like the feeling of seeing your art printed onto fabric, or better yet, seeing someone across the globe purchase it and make something amazing.
You can receive 15% off your next Spoonflower fabric, wallpaper, and gift wrap order. Go to try.spoonflower.com/love to sew. That's try.spoonflower.com/love to sew.
Try it already.
Go try it.
This is a perfect segue into workshops. We want to talk to you about the workshops that you teach, particularly the workshops where you're teaching kids how to sew. But before we get into that, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the different types of workshops that you offer?
Yes. So I offer mainly textile-based crafts. So that includes sewing, hand dyeing, weaving, and screen printing. And I also do a little bit of mixed media workshops. So that might include some stencil making for your screen print and a little bit of collage. But I really like the textile stuff the most. I teach kids ranging from rising first graders through 18-year-olds. And that kind of just melds into adults as well.
So tell us a little bit about how you got into working with kids. What brought you to teaching workshops to, you know, kids under 18?
Yeah, so I was teaching adult classes at the Art Center in Carrboro. And that job I got purely just because it's a really small and creative town. And since I was selling at this store, and also I had been taking classes like ceramics and dance at the Art Center since I was a kid. I think they saw that I was making stuff, so they pulled me in to do adult classes. And then after I'd been teaching adult classes for about a year, they asked me to teach some kids summer camp classes. So for the past 7 or 8 years now, I've been teaching kids sewing at the Art Center in Carrboro. And during the summer, and I also teach close by at a museum for even younger kids, as old as like 5 years old. They just, you know, They needed some sewing help. I think, now that I think about it, I feel like the sewing instructor who had been there for like 20 years had retired, and they kind of needed a sewing person to step in and kind of tell them which sewing machines to order, and what supplies that they needed to stock, and kind of just keep an eye on their sewing studio, and kind of have me give them a list. And then they were like, cool, so you're going to teach, like, what do you want? And from there, I've just been working every summer with these kids. And now they're, you know, there's a bunch of other sewing teachers as well, since I can't work every single summer camp, because the sewing camps sell out the fastest. Well, we keep the sewing camps at a really small group. There's only 6 kids allowed in each session. And that's kind of a number that we set together, knowing that I'm only one person and I need to give individual attention to each kid. We do have a volunteer high school student camp counselor with each group of 6 kids. But a lot of times those camp counselors don't know a thing about sewing and they end up just becoming another student. So realistically, it's like 7 kids that I'm teaching.
This is so cool, though, because we haven't had a chance to talk on the show with a guest who has worked with kids and sewing and teaching kids to sew and sewing with kids. So we really want to pick your brain about this a little bit, because I think a lot of our listeners out there might have kids, either their own kids or kids in their life that they want to sort of pass on this craft to. So my first question for you is just, what is it like working with kids? What is the difference between working with kids and working with adults in a workshop setting?
Well, I feel like they're two completely different, I don't know, beasts, maybe. I do want to preface that I only work with kids like in that summer camp or that workshop environment. I haven't like worked with a group of kids for a full year, and I certainly don't have kids of my own. So I'm just talking from experience of like working with kids for 3 hours every day for a week, or for like a 3-hour weekend session or something like that. So with that in mind, they're usually really excited to be there. You know, it's not a mandatory thing. It's like summer camp. Summer camp is fun. And with that, I try and keep the projects really flexible. And I also build a lot of structure, but flexible structure, into our week of summer camp together. So kind of factoring in that like, oh, this project is going to take longer for certain students and not so much for other students. So maybe I'll have a little side project in for those really able-bodied students who just kind of jump right in and go for it. Whereas some other students might need a whole bunch of individual help. So like, let me make sure that I'm not rushing them or making them feel like they're falling behind, which can be really impactful for anybody, and kind of clouds the positive energy that is required to do a creative project and have fun with it, and to then want to have such a positive experience that they keep doing it. And that's really my goal with teaching kids how to sew. I feel like I personally did so much growth when I kind of latched on to textiles and sewing as like my thing. It's given me lots of confidence and independence, and I just want to share that. And so the fact that I can teach kids and kind of expose them to things that potentially will make them feel really special in the future or in the present encourages me to set very realistic goals and be just really supportive to like their every need while they're in my classroom. When it comes to teaching adults, I feel like I have a little bit of a different mindset, because every adult comes in with a different goal, you know. It's very different from kids who maybe don't even know that sewing is something that they could do. With adults, it's more so like convincing them that it's okay for them to not be good at something and just to go for it, which is a little bit harder for me because I'm a self-proclaimed imperfectionist. I don't focus on being perfect at anything at all. So when I have students who are adults who are really caught up on being perfect, I'm kind of like, you're just going to have to get over that. And I feel like with kids, I don't really come up with that problem as much. More so, I find that kids are already conditioned to like dive in headfirst and not doubt themselves and to try a new thing. They're constantly trying new things and kind of being asked to do things. So like paint this picture or draw this picture, or like do this thing, you know? So I feel like kids are just like, I'm like, okay, we're making t-shirts today. And they're all like, okay. Whereas if I walk into an unexpected group of adults and I'm like, we're making t-shirts today, they'll be like, oh, but I've never sewn with knits. So I kind of feel like they're different beasts in themselves. Like I have a very different interaction with teaching kids how to sew and teaching adults how to sew. And they're both really fun and challenging.
Yeah, no, I love that. And you're so right about kids not necessarily being perfectionists, because I think that's totally true. And one of the questions we had for you is age range. Have you found that there's a particular age that's best suited to learning how to sew? Or have you found that, you know, all ages, it kind of everyone just sort of figures it out?
I think that rising third graders are the perfect age to put them on the machine. The rising first graders and rising second graders, they're just a little bit more hard to wrangle and get to focus on sewing on the sewing machine. So I try and focus more so on like hand sewing with kids who are 8 years old. So anybody under the age of eight, I try and focus on doing more hand sewing with. That being said, I have totally taught seven-year-olds how to sew in the sewing machine. It's a little bit more nerve-wracking for me because I'm a little bit more afraid of them just kind of losing control of the sewing machine or like not being able to reach the pedal so that they have like less control over their speed and that kind of stuff. I think 8 year olds and on are the perfect age to start kids sewing on a machine.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that you have an age in mind. And just for our listeners out there, because I had to Google this, I didn't know what rising meant, but it makes a lot of sense because you're teaching in the summer. So a rising third grader would be a second grader going into third grade.
Yes. And maybe it's like a confidence thing with kids, but you know, when I take roll call, it says what grade they're going to be in. And if I'm like, oh, you're a first grader, they'll be like, no, I'm going to be in second grade. Or they'll, and I'm no, like, oh, I'm eight and a half. Exactly. I'm like, oh, excuse me, you are no longer in the first grade. That is correct. You are going to be a second grader. My mistake. And so, yeah, I think saying, you know, that they're a rising second grader gives them a little bit more confidence, or maybe just kind of distinguishes that, like, yes, I am in the right place or whatever. Who knows what it is? More psychology there. Even with 8 year olds, I think all the way up until 10 or 11, kids still haven't quite formed motor functions that are required for like using scissors with a lot of control. So even though I think that kids can jump on the sewing machine when they're, you know, a very mature seven-year-old or an eight-year-old, that still means I cut out a lot of their projects using scissors so that the sewing is the part that they're focusing on. The motor skills, and I explain this to my students, are a vital part to making something look exactly the way you want it to. So a lot of our beginner sewers don't have motor skills, and I have to explain that to them, that like, oh, please let me cut that for you. These scissors are sharp and they're large. And I explained to them that, you know, we have special fabric scissors, and they have written on them in a Sharpie that it says fabric. And that if they try cutting with the other scissors that say craft on them, that they're not going to cut very easily and they could damage their fabric, which means that they might have to start over. And so just by explaining these things to them kind of puts into mind and eases the kid that like, oh, at any point I can ask for help. And also I know when to ask for help. So I do all the cutting. I do a lot of pre-cutting for the kids. So like some of the projects that we work on right off the bat for kids who have never sewn before are like, we always start with hand sewing and then we move to the machine after that. But I start with like pin cushions or little fabric trays, you know, larger pin cushions are just called pillows. So then we move into pillows or adding a pocket onto a pillow. But for those first few projects that I introduce the kids to just the holding the needle or threading the needle, I don't also ask them to cut the fabric out, or you know, doing too many steps can be overwhelming for anybody. So usually it's everybody gets a needle, everybody gets a length of thread about the length of my arm, and then I have some fabric pre-cut out for them that they just are sewing the fabric right sides together, leaving an opening where they can flip it right side out and stuff it. And that's all we focus on for like the first hour or two of any summer camp, any sewing workshop with kids. And then from there, you know, I kind of explain to them about seam allowance, making sure that they have a fresh cut on their thread so that they can thread it through their needle, kind of having them focus on the really tiny details that make sewing, the more technical aspects of sewing. So, you know, there isn't very much like design or maybe even creative opportunity at the very beginning. But I feel like assuring the kids that like I have a plan, and that if they just kind of sit with me for a little bit, then like, yes, I will let them make all the design decisions that they want to. But let's just focus on threading this needle and sewing far enough away from the edge that your stitches don't fall off the fabric, your project doesn't fall apart. And that usually gets them so excited that they're like very willing to like follow directions from there on out for the rest of the week.
So do you ever find that those technical things, like do the kids get bored, or do they lose interest when you're going through that more technical aspects of sewing? Or like you were saying, they just get excited about it the more that you let them do the steps and the more they get into it.
Yeah, I feel like they want to be there. So it's not a mandatory curriculum kind of thing. So I feel like the kids usually want to be there. So I don't necessarily lose their attention, but just kind of guiding them through all the little details and having them focus on the little details to begin with then gives us building blocks for us to, okay, now we're going to pick out our fabric, or now we're going to cut it into a different shape, or now we're going to do curved lines. And since we're doing curved lines, we need to cut notches into our curved seams, which means that we have to have enough seam allowance so that we have space to cut those notches. And since I like have already explained what seam allowances are and they've already been practicing that, then they're like, okay, now we're just doing notches. Like, cool. Like, you know, I have enough space for that. And I feel like having the structure, you know, lets them know that this is more of a technical camp. And if you want to use a sewing machine, which goes so much faster than hand sewing, you kind of have to convince Miss River that you, one, can follow directions, and two, you're not gonna, get too excited and maybe break something or hurt yourself.
Yeah, it sounds like the fact that you have smaller classes probably helps a lot for keeping the kids focused, because you can kind of, you know, keep your eye on everyone and make sure everyone is on track. And I love the idea of starting with hand sewing to get them comfortable with handling textiles and handling a needle and thread, and then moving over to machine sewing. But one of the questions that comes to mind for me is just, you know, there are some dangerous tools in the sewing room. There's scissors and there's needles and there's, you know, pins and all kinds of things that kids can get hurt on. So how do you keep them safe, I guess, is the question. How do you make sure that they're handling those tools correctly and that they're not going to get hurt through the process?
So I keep all of the tools kind of in baskets over to the side of where we're working, so they're not really within reaching distance. You know, if you can imagine like a classroom with one big table where we can kind of sit around and do our hand sewing, and then another big table where there are six sewing machines set up. So that's like a whole nother station. And then I usually have, you know, some kind of a space where I can do my cutting. So that again is on a separate kind of workspace. The things that I give out to them individually are needles. Everybody is responsible for kind of keeping track of their own needle. Everybody gets one extra needle, but beyond that, I try and convince them that there won't be any third chances of, if you lose your needle, please stop losing your needles, children.
I lose my needle all the time.
and then for the first few projects, we don't use pins at all. So we're really working with small projects where we don't need to pin things together. And I think it's really important to have nice, sharp scissors, you know, kind of that rule of thumb in the kitchen that like a dull knife is more dangerous than a sharp knife applies, I think, to the sewing room as well, that a dull pair of scissors are more dangerous and more frustrating than a sharp pair of scissors. So I do like to have kind of those kid size scissors that are nice and sharp, just brand new. They don't have to be like fabric scissors, but if they're new scissors, then we can still cut a piece of thread with a kid's pair of scissors. And then I keep kind of like my teacher scissors separate. And, you know, right off the bat, I have like a little story time right when the kids come in, depending on whether it's in the morning, which means that it's at like 9 o'clock and they just like maybe rolled out of bed and were rushed to be at camp on time, or if it's after lunch, then they're kind of like riled up from having lunch. So right off the bat, I do like a 15-minute story time to kind of settle down the kids and get them just used to listening to my voice. And then we very quietly ease into handing out the needles and having everybody focus on threading the needle. And then I show them how to tie a knot at the end. And a lot of times I'm tying the knots for everybody for a few days. And then we'll just start sewing. And it goes relatively smoothly. I have a lot of kids prick themselves with the needle. That might be like the most painful thing that happens. And I keep Band-Aids, really cute Band-Aids on hand. So if somebody is upset about pricking their needle, regardless of whether it's an actual injury, I volunteer to put a Band-Aid on. And from there, the kid can kind of tell me like, oh, I'm not actually hurt. or they're like, yes, I am drawing blood and I need a Band-Aid.
It's a good lesson to learn.
Yes. But pretty much every single time a kid is like, I pricked myself, I take it very seriously. And I tell them, do you need a Band-Aid? Do you need to take a break? And then usually they're like, no, I'm fine. I'm like, oh, okay, you are fine. And then after a while, they kind of start, they stop mentioning every single time that they prick themselves. I also, you know, if I have a very melodramatic group of kids who are complaining about pricking themselves, I will very like seriously and in a monotone voice be like, well, that's sewing, you know, like that's a part of sewing. I prick myself all the time too. Like, that's just kind of the way it is.
I'm curious because my sister used to be a camp counselor and she had the best stories to share. Like, she would tell us about all of the either, you know, really sweet kids in her class or maybe not so sweet kids in her classes. So we were wondering if you had any stories to share from your experiences at camp.
Yes, I have interactions with those kids, the really sweet ones, the ones that I like love kind of unconditionally, but try not to favorite too much, are the ones who are just like silent and love to sew and are just like making their projects by themselves and aren't freaking out every time their needle, you know, their thread comes undone from their needle or something like that. And I, you know, I give those kids a lot of space because clearly they kind of know what they're doing or they feel confident. And that way I can kind of give more attention to the other kids. But at the same time, I make it a point to like really quietly tell those kids how great of a job that they're doing and how thankful I am of like their diligence. I'm usually like, thank you so much for just sewing on your own. Like, let me know if you need any help, like anything at all. And usually they're like, oh, okay. And then sometimes I will have kids who are just like disagreeable, I guess is the term, where they're just kind of like, I can't do this, or I don't have any experience doing this, or I've just never done this before and I don't think I can do it, or like threading the needle is just too hard and I need help. And for those kids, I'm like, okay, take a deep breath. I'm like right here. that's why I'm here. I'm here to thread that needle. Or if they're like, I can't do this, I'm like, oh, yay. Does that mean I get to do that for you? Because that's my job. I'm here to do that for you. And usually they're like, oh, okay, yeah, I don't have to be like really, I don't have to shout. I'm like, you definitely do not have to shout. I'm sitting right here. There's only seven of us. and kind of keeping that, like, this is really just for fun vibe, is really helpful for those kind of disagreeable kids who, maybe want to do weird things like stick needles in their skin. Why? I don't know. But usually I'm just like, yeah, cool, great, that's gross. You don't know where that needle's been, but now it's definitely been in your skin, so maybe we should like disinfect that and like that's just your needle. And then they're kind of like, oh yeah, that is gross, and like these are shared materials and there are other people in this room. one story where I was doing, it was like a textile camp, so it wasn't just sewing. We were also doing screen printing and tie dyeing. And I had this kid who was just, he was a little bit younger than everybody else. He was like maybe the youngest kid in the class. So he was just kind of being melodramatic in general, kind of pitching a fit at every single step of like, I don't know how to do this, or I've never done this, or just kind of, I don't know, maybe he just felt like intimidated by the older kids or something like that. You know, I was a little bit flustered, and I kind of was like, okay, we're doing the screen printing project, which requires all the kids to cut out a stencil. He was kind of, you know, having a little hissy fit about it. So I kind of told him, like, you can do whatever you want. Like, just do it. Like, whatever you want to do as far as your image, like, I approve of it. Just go for it. And after we had been cutting these stencils for like a day, for like 3 hours of this camp, I looked at it and it said something like not really appropriate for kids. It said something like kill me now, or just something morbid for like an 8-year-old to have thought up. And I was kind of got this like sinking feeling in my stomach of like, oh my God, like, how am I going to explain this to this kid's parents? And so I was kind of like, oh, well, you did a really great job, like, jumping right in. Like, where did this message come from? And he was kind of like, oh, this is from a YouTube video I watch all the time. And I was like, okay, cool. So your parents know that you watch this video. And he was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen it like 100 times. And I was like, cool, because I'm a little bit worried that they're going to be mad at me, because this is like kind of a weird thing for you to put on your art project. But like, you've done such a great job at cutting it out, like, we're just going to go with it. And he was kind of like, yeah, okay. I already told my parents that I was going to do this, or something like that. And I was like, oh, are they mad? And he was like, yeah, they're mad. And I was like, oh. And I was kind of like, okay.
I'm sure that must be hard, balancing the parents' expectations. And yeah, like, the kids are entrusted to you. And so I'm sure that's a lot of pressure. But it sounds like you have a lot of patience and a lot of sounds like you approached that in a reasonable manner. So were they mad in the end?
I don't know. I mean, their child said that they were kind of upset. And then I told the camp quarters and the head of the camp, and I told them what happened. And I was like, you know, I feel like I kind of dropped the ball on this, and, you know, I'm so sorry, and I'm happy to talk to the parents and apologize directly to them. And they were kind of like, don't worry about it. Like, we'll deal with it. And they did. I don't know what happened, but that's kind of like the perk of working with a well-oiled organization, that I don't really have to deal with the parents, because that part is way more intimidating to me. The only time I have to interact with the parents is on family sharing day at this camp. We do on Fridays, like the last 30 minutes of the camp for the week, the parents come in and I have that down to a science. And usually the parents are just so excited to see all the projects that the kids have made that I don't really have any negative interactions with them. But I think that's the only time I was like, oh man, I did not do a good job teaching this kid or directing this kid, but it all worked out just fine. And in that moment, I think you hit on it. It's all about patience. Teaching kids is all about patience and really just being supportive of whatever it is that they want to make, even if it's a little bit weird, and very impractical, just kind of getting on board with whatever they're wanting to do and kind of nurturing whatever it is that they're doing is what I think my job is as like a summer camp instructor, that like, you know, I'm not testing them, or they don't have to meet a certain criteria. But you know, there are things that I want them to walk away with, like feeling like being creative is a really fulfilling activity, and that like with practice they can get better at something, or that they have confidence to come up with a new idea without having to get permission for it, and just going for it. Those things are the things that I want to nurture in my classroom, beyond like the technical skills of sewing. But some of the other things that I do with kids when we first start sewing on the machine is kind of the things to keep them sewing beyond the sewing camp. I have kids do threading drills. So I know that sounds like so much fun. but like I said, we start with hand sewing and then we segue to machine sewing after they've done hand sewing, just to kind of give them an intro to threading the machine or threading the needle and what seam allowance is, and kind of cutting out, you know, projects, or figuring out that you have to cut out a project much larger than how you actually want it to be, and kind of then be able to practice that by hand and being all up in it. When we merge onto the sewing machine, they already kind of have those things in mind, that I have to use the seam allowance. I can't just sew right on the edge of the fabric. I have to thread this needle for the machine to work. You know, those things are already ingrained in them because we started with that in hand sewing. But when we switch to machine sewing, there's so much more that needs to be done. So before I even let them sew, I make them thread the machine 3 times, and they have to show me, and I have to check every single step, and I go through and I count the spool to the first hook is step number 1, down is step 2, 3 is up. You know how it is.
I've been there, yeah.
We know.
Yeah. I count every single step, and then I'll like get to 6 or 7 or whatever, which is the like little hidey hole hook above your needle, and I'll be like, oh, you forgot step that thing, and then you need to, you know, hook that in place, or oh, look, your thread is wrapped around your needle, and that way I can point out to them at any point if they missed something, and then have them fix it. And if they can thread the machine 3 times, then I let them just start sewing on a piece of scrap fabric. And that includes bringing the thread up from the bobbin. And I think that, you know, maybe like 75%, 85% of the issues that we face when sewing is having to do with the thread, how it's threaded and the tension and stuff like that. So a lot of times, like when we're sewing in the classroom, the needle will come unthreaded, and then the kids will be like, oh my gosh, I haven't been sewing. The thread isn't in the needle. And they'll like have a little moment, and I'll be like, well, you know how to fix that. And they'll be like, oh yeah. And I'll be like, yeah, you're in control of the situation, so just rethread it and keep on going. And then they're like, oh yeah, yeah, cool. And then they do that and they just keep on going. So I, even though I'm like, no fun, River, you're doing drills, I'm not going to let you start sewing until you thread that machine 3 times. Then I'm like, okay, now it's all fun and you're in control and you have all this, you know, you have all the tools. Or usually I'm all about like building up kids and being like, you know how to do this, or like, well, please let me help you cut that thing.
Yeah, that all sounds like really great strategies for, you know, getting kids into sewing and having them have that knowledge stick with them. And one of the things I am wondering about is if you know whether or not some of the kids that have taken your workshops in the summer at camp have continued on to sew for themselves at home, or maybe come back to camp another year afterwards. Like, do you keep track of those kids to find out kind of what they're up to and whether they're still into sewing?
Is that legal?
So I don't keep up with them during the year, unless they're really gung-ho when they come to like a different workshop, or their parents sign them up for another workshop or something. But I have taught some of the same kids 5 or 6 times at this point. Some of the kids get signed up for multiple classes during the 10-week summer vacation. So sometimes during the summer, I'll have the same kid 3 or 4 times. And they come back pretty, well, not all of them, but the ones that are really gung-ho about it will come back. And every year they'll, you know, we have beginner to advanced sewing camps at this point. And so I have, you know, I have kids who started hand sewing with me when they were rising third graders and who are now getting ready to enter high school and become a camp counselor themselves. And usually at that point, I'm like, please come back and be a camp counselor for the sewing camp because I have trained you very diligently. Please return and be my assistant. And many times they're like, no, I'm going to do something more interesting. sometimes some of them are like really excited to become camp counselors. So you never know. But I do have kids who come back every year. And there are some kids who come back and they're like, I haven't sewn at all during the year. And when I ask them a few more questions, it's usually that their parents don't know how to sew and they like forgot how to wind the bobbin or something happened to their machine and they didn't know how to fix it. But they themselves wanted to keep sewing. So come summertime again, they got signed up for another camp and they really just needed a refresher. They're like, I don't remember how to do anything. And then there's some kids who come in to camp and they've already been sewing with their grandmother or their aunt or their mom. I feel like more so the kids that I get, their mom doesn't sew. So like when I meet their mom or dad during family sharing, their parents are kind of like, how do we keep this going? And so, you know, I kind of give them the instructions of like, well, you know, just keep on sewing, like figure out a time once a week or once a day or something like that where you guys are doing this, but like make sure that you're cutting all their projects out for them and kind of keep the flow going. But like the thing that I do during family sharing is I have the kids show their parents how to thread the machine. And then I have the parents follow the kids' instruction on how to thread the machine.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So
it's a great idea.
Very, very fulfilling to hear the children verbatim repeat the things that I've been saying all week. Just makes me feel very heard and listened to.
You're like, my work is done here. No, I really love that.
This whole time I thought that you weren't paying attention, but you were, sweet child. You were paying attention.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing all about sewing with kids. This is so cool. I love all of the little tidbits and tips that you've given, and I hope some of our listeners can take that through mm-hmm. and teach their kids or loved ones to sew. I did have one last question, kind of a little bit more of a general question, because you have so much experience working with kids who sew. I'm curious, do you think that we can learn anything from kids in their sewing practice and kind of take that through to our own adult sewing practice?
Oh, yeah. I think kids have it figured out. They they don't question things too much. They like kind of go with the flow. And I approach with kids, I approach sewing like math, where, you know, there's an order of an operations that you kind of have to follow for to get that correct answer. Just like in math, if you want your the raw edges not to show, you gotta sew it inside out first and then flip it right side out. That's how we make it look really nice on the outside. And I feel like kids are like all about just kind of like, you know, going along with the rules, but at the same time, they have no expectations and no hangups. So I think that's something that I'm always looking to kids to kind of remind myself of that they're like, oh, I want to do this and I want to do that. And then I want to add this to it. And having sewn for so long, I feel like I have kind of taught myself to stay to that order of operations a little bit too rigidly. And I don't always like, I'm never like, oh, I'm going to add that zipper in afterwards. You know, because I'm like, no, I need to add it in far in advance so that it's very easy for me to put it all together. Like, I would never add a zipper in after I put the waistband, or, you know, whatever the rules are. And I feel like with kids, they're like, I want to do this thing now. And it usually takes me a second of like unhinging my adult expectations and reminding myself that, like, yeah, sewing is fun and we can break all the rules. And in fact, those rules don't really even exist unless we want them to. And so I just love going back and teaching kids every summer. And nowadays I'm kind of incorporating teaching kids on a more regular basis, just kind of like on the weekends or that kind of thing. And it's really fun. I've been teaching these workshops at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and it's like a parent-child craft day. So a parent has to accompany a child. And it's so much fun to see the parents unhinge from their like role as the adult. And it's really the adults who end up being more messy than the kids in a lot of my weekend workshops. And I'm so happy to see that because I feel like they are learning from their kids, because I'm usually like, okay, we're going to make this thing. And the kids are like, okay, I'm getting my paint and I'm picking this out and I'm not overthinking it. And meanwhile, the parent is kind of watching them and they're like, well, what color do you want? What should we do? And the kid is just kind of like, I'm doing it already. And so I feel like that is just the best, is breaking all the rules with kids to make art, especially in sewing, when it can feel like there are a lot of rules sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think our listeners are definitely going to take something from this conversation, talking about sewing with kids, going with the flow more, not getting hung up on the details, lowering their expectations, ditching perfectionism. I think there's like so much that we can take away from this. So thank you so much again for talking to us about all of this. And can you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
Yes, I am most active on my Instagram, which is just RivTak, RivTak. And then I have my portfolio and all of my calendar of upcoming events, classes, workshops on my website, which is RivTak.com. And I also have some products available on my website as well. I have a little e-commerce section there. And if they live on the East Coast of America, they can find some of my products in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, or right here in North Carolina. So yeah, but mostly my website is where I'm trying to update the most things. And you all have really inspired me to kind of get into blogging. I just made my first blog post about making my wedding dress like a few weeks ago. So hopefully more on the blog as far as like workshops and kids projects and stuff like that.
That's awesome to hear that you're doing that. And we'll link your wedding dress post in the show notes as well, because I'm sure our listeners will want to check that out. Thank you so much again for coming on the show. We obviously had a great time chatting. We've been chatting for a while now. We really appreciate all of your knowledge and we can't wait for our listeners to go find you online.
That's it for today's episode of Love to Sew. Thank you to our sponsor, Spoonflower. Go to try.spoonflower.com/love to sew to get 15% off your next order.
We're recording in rainy Vancouver, Canada, and you can get in touch with us and get links for everything we talked about in this episode at lovetosewpodcast.com.
If you're loving the show and want to help us out, you can support us on Patreon. Contribute $5 or more a month and you'll get access to our bonus episode feed. Go to patreon.com/lovetosew for more info.
You can find me, Helen, at helenscloset.ca and Caroline at blackbirdfabrics.com. Our show is produced by Sam Humphrey.
Thank you, Sam.
And thank you all so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Go. Oh my God. Sorry.
You need to take a deep breath. Go with the flow. Lower your expectations.